ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय यदाचितं प्रसीदेत इन्द्रियाणां च निवृत्ते देहे वयं मनुसंगं तत्सत्त्वं देहिमत्पदम् यदाचितं प्रसीदेत इन्द्रियाणां च निवृत्ते देहे वयं मनुसंगं तत्सत्त्वं देहिमत्पदम्
When chitam, the consciousness,
prasidita,
becomes clear,
indriyanam,
of the senses,
cha,
end,
nirvite,
cessation of their mundane activities,
dehe,
in the body.
Abhayam,
fearlessness.
Manaha,
of the mind.
Asanga,
detachment.
Tat,
that.
Sattvam,
the mode of goodness.
Vidhi,
know it.
Mat,
realization of me.
Param,
the situation in which such can be achieved. Translation. When consciousness becomes clear and the senses are detached from matter, one experiences fearlessness within the material body and detachment from the material mind. You should understand this situation to be the predominance of the mode of goodness in which one has the opportunity to realize me.
Om Jnana Timarandasya Jnandana Salakaya Chakshurin Militam Yena Tasmai Si Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Vistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Pada Kamalam Sri Gurum Vaisnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sagana Raghunatan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvetam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sagana Lalita Sivisakanvitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindho Dinabandho Jagatpate Gopesa Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namastute Tapta Kanchana Gorangi Radhe Vrindavaneswari Vrishabhanu Suttadeve Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpa Tarubhyacha Sakripa Sindhubhyevacha Paditanam Pavanevyo Vaisnavevyo Namo Namah Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sivasadi Ghora Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
So the three modes of material nature are creating so many different varieties of situations consisting of form, taste, touch, sound, and smell. And all these combinations of form, taste, sound, touch, and smell are somehow or other attracting our mind. And as soon as we think that some happiness will be attained there, we are looking for shelter. Taking shelter means there where we rest our faith. And faith is based on where we think happiness can be found. Anandamay Vyasat. The living being by nature is pleasure seeking. Therefore, wherever we think that this pleasure or happiness can be attained, our faith will be invested, and that's where we'll put our energy and attachment will develop. And thus, we enter into all kinds of relationships with these varieties of form, taste, touch, sound, and smell. But the fact of the matter is that real happiness is only found in Krishna. And therefore, we take shelter of the holy name. Because that is how we can access Krishna immediately. Wherever we are, in any condition of life, Krishna is always available to us very quickly through chanting his name. Lord Chaitanya pointed out that in the matter of chanting Hare Krishna, one should never consider oneself as the master of the name. That now I am mastering this art of chanting. I've been chanting so many years, I know how to do. No, one should not think that one is the master of the name, but rather one should think that he's the servant of the name, or that we need to take shelter of the name. That is our point again and again. The name is our shelter. The name is where our hope for happiness will be placed. And that is the only place where that hope for happiness belongs, because there it can be fulfilled. So, in the mode of goodness, this kind of knowledge becomes known, but it is still theoretically, because we are still not actually reposing our faith at the lotus feet of Krishna or in his name. We are still reposing our faith everywhere else, but we know that actually is due to being conditioned by the illusory energy, and we know that we should detach from all such entanglement with the sense objects, and that we should really repose all our hopes at Krishna's lotus feet. That is basically the mode of goodness. The mode of goodness, therefore, is particularly based on knowledge. It is the mode of enlightenment. It is the mode where we understand what to do. Pravritim cha nivritim cha. What is right, what is wrong, what is prescribed duty, what is not prescribed duty. In the mode of goodness, we know. Therefore, we are always situated in knowledge. But still, vidvamsam api kersati, even a man who is situated in knowledge is still struggling, is not rising above the struggle of material existence. Because the senses have become attached to material sense objects. So therefore, the senses have to become redirected. We simply, for too long, have engaged in the wrong direction, and therefore it will take some time to again get in the right course and to make progress. Therefore, from the mode of goodness, it will take some time. We find that just there are three modes, and that these modes can combine in many varieties. And it is explained that they are a multiplication of three. 3 × 3, 9 × 3, 27 × 3, 81 × 3, and so on. And that in this way, various combinations come about of the modes of material nature. An example can be given. For example, we may be, well, theoretically, it would be possible that a person would be in sattva, completely in goodness. But it would also be possible that there would be a person who would be in sattva, rajas. So then there's this, that little pinch of rajas. So the person is basically situated in prescribed duty, always acting according to scripture, always cultivating deeper knowledge, but sometimes, just on the horizon, there would be a little rajas, a little bit of desire to enjoy the senses. A person could also be in sattva. He would be still very much inclined towards knowledge, still very much inclined to always cultivate transcendence. But because the rajas is now stronger, he would struggle more with the desire for sense gratification. A person could also be in rajas, sattva. In this case, rajas, or passion, the desire to enjoy sense gratification, would be predominant. But because there is sattva attached to it, there would always be that voice in the back, no, better we don't do this. So the tendency would be, yes, and then sort of from the back, the brakes, no, oh yeah, okay, no, we are in goodness, yes. No. So that would be raja sattva. So you can see how you can get very interesting combinations. We can, of course, go for, tamas, or raja tamas, or raja tamas sattva. So, you can think about always the desire to enjoy, a tendency to just forget knowledge, but somewhere in the background still a little bit of inclination to higher knowledge, an attraction to it, raja tamas sattva. So like that we can see how the psychology of a person can be made up out of different influences. One can see these things in an astrological chart, because the astrological chart is showing various influences. For example, there is Venus in the chart, which shows lust. How lust and a desire for enjoying material circumstances is being channeled. If this Venus is exalted in the chart, it means it is situated in an environment of sattva, then one's Venus will be used to create an enjoyable atmosphere in the mode of goodness, everything nice and clean and wonderful. But when the Venus is more predominated by rajas, then it comes more down to the basic instincts, and when it comes down to tamas, it's outright animalistic. Okay? So in this way, that was the Venus. Then we have, for example, the influence of Mercury. Mercury is the ability, it is kind of the material intelligence, the ability to quickly analyze and to quickly move. Mercury will also give us communication skills and so on. So now if the Mercury influence is in goodness, well, then we will be inclined towards making nice structured, nice quick arrangements. We'll naturally be able to very quickly make arrangements in the mode of goodness very quickly. When Mercury is in the mode of goodness, when Mercury is in the mode of passion, we'll be very quick in finding ways for sense gratification. We immediately see all kinds of opportunities like that. And of course, when Mercury is in tamas, then it will pull us down. The nature of Mercury is very fast. So Mercury is one type of intelligence. Another type of intelligence is Jupiter in the chart. Jupiter is related to buddhi, to wisdom. It is the type of intelligence related to wisdom. It is different than the material intelligence. Someone with a strong Mercury goes on a computer and in seconds figures it out. Someone with a weak Mercury sits in front of the thing and is going, like, how does this work? But someone with a strong Jupiter, by nature, will be inclined towards wisdom and knowledge that is relating to self-realization. So when Jupiter is placed very well in one's astrological chart, then naturally we'll see this person is deeply rooted in his life, in his inclination towards spiritual life. That means Jupiter in the mode of goodness, Jupiter in the mode of passion. One will have an inclination for sense gratification, but will still do it be inclined to express it in an appropriate way, because there's the Jupiter along with the inclination for passion. Jupiter in ignorance, it's like there Jupiter is at his weakest point, obviously, and such a person will have very poor knowledge and will be always inclined towards the wrong thing, like the fly, naturally attracted to the negative things, automatically finding them, no matter what, right? Where it is, that's where it is, found it, some degraded thing. That is the nature when Jupiter is placed in Tamagun in the chart. So the chart therefore tells us how a person is situated in the modes of material nature. But it's a combination of many planets, of many factors. So, taking it back now to the philosophy, one can see that our consciousness is consisting of different components, and all these components are not necessarily in the same mode. So one component can be in goodness, another component can be in passion, and again another component can be in ignorance. Like I gave the example of the planets, and all that makes the cocktail, which is our consciousness. And in this way, you can find that one time you're dealing with one person, and the next time you're dealing with another person. And you think, how is this possible? I mean, I'm really shocked. I thought this person had a particular nature, and now I'm finding out there's a whole different side. As if someone has many faces. Because there are these different components or different influences in the consciousness which can be seen through different planets. Anyway, astrology is such a thing that it displays to us our previous karma and how our consciousness is made up of various components. But of course, a transcendentalist is not bound at all by the chart. One can totally rise above. It may be a struggle, though. It may be a struggle if one's Venus is situated in a very Rajasic position, then obviously one will be strongly afflicted by lust. But that doesn't mean that one has to give in to that lust. So it's not when we see in the chart now the Venus is in a Rajasic position, this person must get married. Must. It's not absolutely so. But this person, we can see, has a strong affliction of lust. So we'll have a great battle. So most likely the Grihastha ashram would be more suitable. But if the person is very determined, on the other hand, to go for spiritual life, then it would be possible to transcend the influence of that planet. Therefore, astrology is not something that binds us. And it's not that the astrological chart is like a script that determines our life. Here's my chart and this is it. I'm destined to act like this. There's nothing I can do. I'm now going in my Saturn period, you know. I'm probably going to divorce because I'm probably going to be very renounced now. No. We can simply take our destiny in our hand, but we will have to struggle with our planets. So spiritual life means fighting with your planets. I don't want to do a whole class in astrology. Maybe I got influenced by the poster on the notice board, you know, of Bhanu Maharaj's astrology seminar. It could be. Astrology in my mind, and it now comes out. I'll leave it up to Maharaj. He is the astrologer, and I'm only an amateur at best. I never was so much into astrology, but one summer I was in Vrindavan and everyone had left and there were only
Hare Krishna.
There were only three senior devotees in the temple left, and everyone had gone to a cooler place, and they would speak all day about astrology from morning to night. My sixth house, his ninth house, and I was getting like, what is all these houses, and this, that. So then I thought, okay, alright, I'm going to read a book, you know, I'm going to find out about it. So that's how I became an astrologer on an off day. So now I know how it works. It's not so difficult.
I believe you're wrong.
Good. Thank you. Anyway, but more than astrology, are we interested in devotional service? The reason why I'm bringing it up is because we have this consciousness, which is a combination of different components, and we cannot ignore it. We cannot just shake it off. We cannot just be somebody else. We are what we are. We start out with our particular conditioning. It's not just going to change. But in devotional service, we can write above. Good.
Can we have questions and answers after the recording?
Fair enough.
There will be an opportunity for everyone.
That's nice.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah. It's like... Look. You're a good guy, and you're most welcome, and we appreciate you here. At the same time, you know, we have a system, and our system is like we let the speaker... Let's listen. We let the speaker develop an idea, and we don't interrupt. Because otherwise, if everyone interrupts, then the idea cannot be developed. Then, after some time, we'll just open it up for discussion. So you get your chance to halt your horses. Okay, so shanti, keep cool. Yes, so the modes of material nature in this way are afflicting us, but we are not helpless in the matter. The modes of material nature may create waves for us, and these waves come through our consciousness due to our conditioning and these influences I described now a little bit, coming in astrological terms, so we can clearly see that they are there. But we can rise above. And that is what we can do by taking shelter. If you do it again, we're going to ask you to leave.
I just want to ask one thing, please. What star sign are you?
Okay. It's really, really not on. It's not on. Richard, cool it. You get, Richard, Richard, you're going to ask your questions at the end. I'll tell you everything at the end. Just wait. Just wait. You get your chance. I will give you time. Yeah? Okay. We're back. So, the waves are there. You know, the waves are there that drag us along, but we can swim in another direction. Yes. And the more we take shelter of devotional service, the stronger we become as a swimmer. And the less these waves will have a grip on us. And the more we can determine our course, and the less we are dragged along by the currents and the undercurrents. And that is an interesting point to consider. So we are not helpless. We are not at all forced. You know, we're not forced to just act by the modes. But depending which mode influences, we will be stronger swept up in the waves. What to do? Anyway, we must somehow or other carry on. My star sign is Pisces, that's why swimming and waves and oceans and all these things. Now you know. Okay. Right. But leaving that aside, we are interested in Krishna. Yeah. And Krishna can pull us above these modes of material nature, but we will not just be free from the influences. And if we have a nature, as I described, of Rajas, Rajas, Sattva, or something like that, then we can expect that if transcendental knowledge comes in the middle of that, that we'll have years of struggle with our passionate nature. That passionate nature will be there. If we are very much in goodness, so alright, then we'll slot in more easily in Krishna consciousness. Immediately the mind will be less agitated, more peaceful. But due to these influence of the mode, the agitation may remain. And the other day I was referring to the Madhurya Kadambi, and I was pointing out that in the beginning our Krishna consciousness is like a little island. It becomes like a tiny little island within our consciousness. And the material influences are very strong within our consciousness. I compare them to a big ship and a little island. We stay with the water metaphors. A little island, an ocean, and then a big ship filled with material desires, waving at us very close. This will go on. This will go on at first. But then, as we are getting more advanced, the island grows in size. And then gradually it says, as Anartanavriti goes on, the ship with material desires goes at more distance. And at Nista, when we are fixed in our determination that we want Krishna, and when we have strong faith, that's where happiness is. But we still have attachments to material things, but we know it's not really going to do it. Yeah. Then, you know, we are going to... then we see the ship is far away. Then it says, when Ruchi arrives, at that time gradually, because the material influence is less, our taste in Krishna consciousness is begins to spread over the surface of our entire consciousness. So in Ruchi there may be some influence of passion, but one's whole consciousness
is filled with taste
in Krishna consciousness.
So this ruchi is a very nice state. It said in the Ashakti, this ruchi, which is over the surface of the entire water, goes deeper and goes under the surface. So it begins to penetrate deeper and deeper in Ashakti, in our consciousness. And thus, but the material influence is still there. It said in Ashakti, the material influence is on the horizon. The ship is now on the horizon. And gradually it begins to disappear over the horizon. It is said that in Bhava, the ship has become a shadow. It has become a shadow. So that's very interesting, because a shadow means it's not there and it's there at the same time. The real thing, the real material desire is no longer there, but the shadow means one still knows. One may not have the desire, but one knows that, but if I would want to, I could. The option, the back door is still there. That's still the options. That's the shadow of material desire. And it's still material desire in a subtle form, but one doesn't feel affected by it in the heart. One is not struggling with the material desires. But the back door, one still sees, well, I could go in the sense gratification direction. I could be the sense enjoyer if I wanted to, but I don't want. I want Krishna. That is still there, sort of, in the background. But only a shadow on the horizon. So it's in the background. It's just sort of far in the consciousness. In praying, the whole ocean just becomes like ecstatic love. Ecstatic love. That's basically what we're looking at. So I like this metaphor a lot. Right? Somehow or other, maybe because of the Pisces, I have a thing with water, and I kind of like this metaphor of the ocean, as the mind or the consciousness comparing to an ocean. It's done many times in the scripture. For example, in the verse Apuryamanam Achala Pratistam Apar Samuda Pravisanti Yatvat Tatvat Kama Yat Pravisanti Sarve Sasanti Adnuti Nakama Kami, which is the metaphor of all the rivers of desires going into the ocean. And it said, but the ocean is so full that all these rivers cannot disturb the ocean. The water level stays the same. It doesn't affect the ocean due to its fullness. Right? These rivers have no real effect. So this verse has some special meaning to me, because when I received sannyas, it was in the Bhaktivedanta manner. And actually I had come from Radhadesh, and in between England and Belgium, where Radhadesh is situated, there is the channel, there's water. So I decided to just take a ship, take a boat. So I went by bus and boat. And when I came back after sannyas, I was on the boat and I was looking at the ocean. And then that verse came to mind. Apuryamanama Achalapratistam. I saw the sea. The verse says samudra, that means the sea, the ocean. And I was thinking, yes, this is now the position, sannyas. Now it is the time to just let the desires go into the consciousness, whatever. But due to the fullness, no meaning, no effect. So I was meditating on this verse after sannyas. Then when we take that metaphor of further, and we see how Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur filled it in, like I just explained, how the taste spreads over the surface and goes deeper, and gradually the material influences disappear altogether. That is a very nice description of spiritual life. and of how we go from the modes of material nature to pure goodness, to Visuddhisattva, to the transcendental platform. It shows the whole progression very nicely. So therefore, I think it's a valuable metaphor, which one can find in Madhurya Kadambini, a small book actually, worth reading, really. Because it gives us a better handle on what we are doing, actually, in our process of devotional service. Because sometimes we are experiencing confusion, but how is it that I'm still being disturbed? That I'm still being so disturbed? I'm trying so much, I'm trying to take shelter of the Holy Name, and I'm still being disturbed by desires or agitation in my mind, and will this never go away? But when we're looking at the descriptions of Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, we can exactly understand how the disturbance remains and to what degree it remains. The ship is definitely going further away, and the ship is definitely disappearing more and more into the background. The material desires are no longer just in the center of our attention. They sort of appear on the horizon. Here they are again. So gradually the agitation also becomes smaller. Srila Prabhupada says that he uses another metaphor. He says spiritual life is like going up in a plane, and everything that was so big before becomes smaller as you go up. All the big material things become smaller and smaller and smaller and more insignificant. So that is the same point, but explained in another way. So that is the reality. So we need not worry. Material agitation is not such an issue. The mind being disturbed, what to do? We just have to see somehow or other in the combination of planets that we have. The moon is the planet that governs the mind. So if the mind is always disturbed, it simply means that the moon is not situated in a very sattvic environment. If the house where the moon, or the environment where the moon is placed in the firmament, is predominated by goodness, then the mind is always peaceful. But if the moon is situated somewhere in a place of passion, then the mind is always agitated for desires of enjoyment. And when the moon is placed in a position of ignorance, then the mind is always predominated by fear and anxiety. Then even when there's no anxiety, no reason for being anxiety, what is an anxiety? It's just like, you know, just anxiety. It's the natural state of consciousness. It's just anxiety. You know, it's like, why anxiety? I'm just like, you know, just in anxiety about being in anxiety, and I'm in anxiety because I'm always in anxiety, and that gives me a lot of anxiety, if you know what I mean. And it can go many levels deep. So what can be said about that? That is simply the moon. The moon. Some moon in one's karma, the moon is not in a very good location. It's not in a good mode of nature. What to do? One has to tolerate it. One has to simply tolerate that. So with such a, it will harass us then for a longer time. As it is said, that the material influence becomes less, the ship goes at a greater distance. But what is in your ship? So if your ship has like a bad moon, ship loaded with bad moon, well, then when the ship is still there on the horizon, then it's the moon that's there again. And the moon, the lunatic, and so on, the lunar influence will then emerge from time to time. And we may even And we may be prone to illusion, we may be prone to all kinds of imaginary fears and disturbances, and our mind tends to go into it. Let it go, fight it. That is, so spiritual life is a fight. The fighting with these influences. And knowledge is helpful. We see it in this discussion. It becomes more mapped out, more visible. I've simply tried to sort of create some sort of map where we can see these influences working in ourselves and we get a better grip on them. So maybe with this little description of the modes of nature influencing us, we get a better handle on the situation, and maybe we can also go into that astrology retreat in a more conscious manner, like, and see how it relates to us and how we can fight better with the modes of nature that influence our consciousness, because we don't want to be controlled by the modes of nature. We don't want to be controlled by them. We want to be controlled by Krishna. And by Krishna only. That is what we want. So we want to be free from these modes. And it is a bit of a fight. And that is why it is said that spiritual life is like declaring war on Maya. And we can now see how Maya has infiltrated our consciousness through the modes of material nature. Okay, I'll end. Questions, comments? Yes.
So, similarly, in spiritual life, it takes quite a few years to get to see the. Like Maharaj was making this point actually. It takes so much training to be able to see the actual spiritual reality.
Yes.
In comparison to the material illusions.
Yes.
So,
yes.
And he was opening up that invitation for all. It was like a scientific audience. So, he was opening up that invitation to all of them to experiment and keep their observation. Skills like fine tune between taking up spiritual practices attentively again alongside observing how their life changes, their consciousness changes, their lifestyle changes, their association changes. So like, the more we are into the spiritual practices, the more our everything changes.
Yeah.
So it's like he was taking that as an example.
Yeah.
So would you like to expand on?
Well, I don't know. That's a fact. You know, I mean, it is a gradual process, and as we're going through the process, we can witness the changes, but we also have a choice. It is a gradual process. We cannot just shake off this influence of the modes, like I said, but we have a choice to give in to the material conditioning or not. My mind may tell me, I have an example. It's early in the morning, it's cold, you're walking downtown, you're hungry. You know what I mean? You're walking in the street, and suddenly you come past the baker.
Your mouth starts to water. You smell that smell of fresh baked bread. So now, because we have knowledge, immediately we'll realize, no, this is not bona fide, this bread. This is bogus. This is bogus bread. It's not bona fide. There are impure substances in it. No. But the tongue is watering. The mouth is watering. Right? The nose is like totally registering warm baked bread. Yeah. So this is how it works with the senses. So the senses send us one signal, and but we, with knowledge, with realization, we know no. So now we can give in to the senses and say, well, you know, don't. If we give in to the senses, then we use the intelligence to fulfill the desire of the senses. Don't be a fanatic. Come on. And the other, or if the intelligence is fixed in goodness, say, no, I will not have this bread. I'll have some other bread some other time, but not this bread, because this is not bona fide. So this is an example of how we become aware and how we are from within being confronted with material influences which we'll have to ignore, which means we'll have to fight with them, because, you know, ignoring is not so easy. The desire says, I want to be fulfilled. We say, no. Then the desire says, wait a minute. I am serious here. I want to be fulfilled. You understand? We say, no. And the desire says, now listen, you know. You're going to do what I say. No. Like that. It's not just so easy. There is a fight. But in this way, because we see that gradually, as we are going through this fight, that gradually the intensity of the material attraction diminishes. And gradually the pushings of the senses become less. And in this way, we notice some progress. And that gives us faith to carry on. And in quantum mechanics, they think there is an attraction between several molecules, and that's all there is. But what they don't see is that really it is Krishna. It is simply Krishna who is arranging for this attraction. There is no attraction between the molecules, but it is Krishna who arranges all these things and who in his energies creates these different forces that influence each other. So it is simply Krishna, a boy who's sitting at a pond and who is looking at his own reflections. Parashya Shakti Rividaiva Suyate, Krishna playing with his unlimited energies of so many varieties. That in quantum mechanics they can't see. And now this whole quantum mechanics is being presented to us in this spiritual jacket, you know, by a group of people who put out videos like The Secret and What the Bleep, and are just pushing quantum mechanics and speak about the law of attraction, and how if you simply are thinking of something, then you attract it. It will happen. But we know that actually that's not a fact. We know there's some defect in it. So even going back to quantum mechanics, there are limitations. It has only limited application. But that the scientists haven't discovered yet, because they haven't discovered Krishna yet. But once, so if they go from quantum mechanics to Krishna mechanics, then one day they'll get the real perspective and they'll see reality as it is. So even the scientist is seeing only a level of reality. He doesn't see reality. Because the real law of attraction is Krishna is attracting everyone. Mahatmaji.
Is it true that Maharaj said the devotee is lying in the deep part of the ocean and he is not affected by the three modes?
You're taking another metaphor.
Yeah.
Or you take the water metaphor and you're filling it in with the example from the introduction of the Nectar of Devotion, where it is said that the devotees are like sharks. Devotees there are compared to sharks, not because devotees have teeth and bite, but because sharks, they swim only in deep water, and you will never find a shark in a river. Sharks swim only in deep water. So in that metaphor, the rivers are compared to the philosophies of impersonalists and all kinds of others, bogus philosophies. And the ocean is compared to the nectar of devotion, the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, the ocean of bhakti. And the sharks are the devotees who are swimming deep, deep in that ocean. And they are never affected by whatever happens on the surface. And therefore, whatever goes on in the world will not affect the sharks. They are deep down there in the ocean of bhakti. So,
absorbed
in devotional service, absorbed in the holy name or serving the holy name. We either chant the holy name or we serve the holy name. That is what we do. What does it speak about?
Fearlessness.
Yes. Yeah, fearlessness comes from dependence on Krishna, and fearlessness comes in two degrees. There may be sometimes still some fear within our heart, but at the same time we also have so much faith in Krishna that he'll protect us that we can ignore this emotion. So like that we can be fearless. And then gradually the fearless goes deeper and deeper to a point where even there's no trace of the feeling in the heart. So it's also a gradual development, fearlessness. So one who is in Krishna prema, when there's no more shadow of the material influence, then there's also no trace of fear left. Because it says in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, it says that one who is in bhava is still to some degree influenced by the five types of suffering in the material world. Still influenced by klesha. So to some extent, still influenced by fear. Yes. But in prema, there is no more influence of suffering at all. There's no more fear. So that's quite... Then there's no trace left in the heart. So in our metaphor, it's also a gradual increase in fearlessness. But the Nista one is already fearless, because one fearlessly puts his faith in Krishna and acts upon the instruction of Krishna. Although within the heart there may be a little bit of anxiety, but still one goes forward. One goes forward. That is already fearlessness. So it develops and develops. Yes?
It's nice to hear that the more Krishna conscious we become, the less material consciousness we'll have. But I've also heard that the more Krishna conscious we become, the more we purify our consciousness, the more we're able to see our inner dirt of our consciousness, and that's scary when I hear that. But I've heard those examples as well, that it's going to become more prominent, your material desires, the more you become self.
Well, you know, that is in the earlier stages that we become more aware of the affliction of the modes of material nature. Surely we become more and more aware, but in our metaphor of the ship going further and further to the horizon,
So in the beginning, when the ship is very close, we'll be overwhelmed by the material desires. And when the ship is so close, you cannot even get a good look of the whole ship. All you see is the ship in front of you, this big thing, right? It's this big thing, but you cannot see the contours of the ship very well. Later on, when the ship is a little further, you can oversee the contours of the ship better. You can better see like how you're afflicted by the most material nature. So in the beginning, when the ship is in our face, then we experience the overwhelming nature of material desires, but we cannot oversee so well how we are afflicted by so many material desires. Later on, as the ship is further away, as we're more advanced, then we can get a better overview on how all these material influences work on us, like that. But it is not that as we are going into the process that the material desires will increase and increase. It can be that sometimes a material desire is for a while under the surface and then emerges. Ships also do that because they disappear behind the waves sometimes. The wave. So that's also there. Yeah. So sometimes we don't see the desire and then it's back on the top of the wave. And then it's gone behind the wave. Yeah. The mode sometimes being a desire to the surface and sometimes under the surface. But they will decrease, so don't worry. Yes?
Are you encouraging us to all understand and very give our astrological chart down so that we understand ourselves?
Well, you know, there's a pro and con to that, right? You see, a lot of people, although I said that we need not be dictated by the positions of the planets and what is strong, we can rise above it and we can fight with whatever these planets dictate us to do. A lot of people, once they get into their chart, they just tend to surrender to the chart and just say like, well, what can I do? The astrological chart. They just surrender to that. They say, what can I do? And they just say, oh, well, you know, I'm going in a Rahu period. There's nothing I can do, you know. I mean, it's all over my chart. I'm not going to be able to follow the step, the Dharma, and I will fall down from Dharma.
That's when they throw in the towel, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. That's when they throw in the towel. You got it. Yeah. So that's the risk. He's right, that we would throw in the towel. So therefore, Prabhupada told us, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. It will change anyway by devotional service. Just get strongly engaged in devotional service. So I don't recommend, you know, that everyone gets his chart done and this and that. It's not absolutely required because it may be just another form of self-indulgence which will take us away from Krishna. But if inadvertently it happens sort of on the way, you meet Mr. Astrologer or Mrs. Astrologer or whatever, you meet an astrologer and you are, and they say, here it is, well, okay, you know, have a look. But we can rise above, for sure. It says in the 11th canto that the birth chart applies to what takes birth. And the soul never takes birth, it says there. So, the more we get on the spiritual platform, the less influence astrology will have on us. Anyone else?
Absolutely. You were a demonstration of anxiety, you know, what, there's nothing for me to be anxious about, I'm anxious about, and there's nothing to be anxious about.
There's nothing to be anxious about?
No, I'm anxious that there's nothing to be anxious about.
Yes.
Like nth degree of anxiety.
Yes. Yeah, okay. So?
How does a person come out of it?
How do you get out of this anxiety? Well, such anxiety Bhayam dvitiya binivesita syat. Fear or anxiety arises when we separate ourselves from Krishna. So it is due to seeing things separate from Krishna. So the more we see things related to Krishna, the more anxiety will disappear. That is the way. So we have to just see everything related to Krishna and to start thinking of things related to Krishna. But when we, it clearly means that if we have a lot of anxiety in Krishna consciousness, is that we have compartments, that we have Krishna on one side. We have Krishna on the one hand, and we still see areas separate from Krishna. We don't see everything in the perspective of Krishna. So we're still a little bit Kanista, who sees Krishna in the temple, but doesn't see Krishna everywhere. And we really see Krishna everywhere, then we see everything in relation to Krishna. Then what's the need for anxiety?
It looks like the person with anxiety is not strong enough to see Krishna everywhere.
Well, then he has to hear, and then he has to associate with devotees, and then automatically Krishna will enter into your consciousness.
That's the positive.
You know, if you're one day here in the temple, you get a lot of Krishna.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it doesn't matter what mode of nature you're in, you're going to get it. Yeah? And it works in the consciousness. And if you're regularly in the temple, in the association of devotees, gradually Krishna will come more in the foreground in our consciousness. And with it, anxiety will decrease. Gradually, one day, we'll become Vaikuntha people, free from anxiety. Kunta is anxiety. Vaikuntha, without anxiety.
Looks like we're finished. Atisha is the last.
The last snare of Maya, or the last desire is Mayavadi.
I am God.
Yeah.
Why? Well, because, you know, it is the... We all are developing false ego in this world. And we start to identify with a false position. I am the bank director. Mm-hmm. I am the president. I am the doctor. I am beautiful. I am powerful. I am intelligent. I am so many things. Yeah. So this is false ego. So the Mayavadi is trying to lose his ego, because he's basically saying ego is false. He's saying, but in the process of trying to lose his ego, he thinks that he is God. That is the biggest egoistic or egocentric concept you can have. I am everything. So it's the ultimate false ego. You couldn't get any bigger false ego than that. It's like, you know, someone comes around, he's got a false ego like a house, and Mayavadi's got a false ego, you know, it's like bigger than the universe. He's got the huge false ego. That's why it's the last snare of Maya. I am everything. Not only I am something, you know. And everyone's trying to prove, look, you know, I'm not nothing, I'm something, you know. But the Mayavadi is, I'm everything. Can you imagine?
Can that happen to a devotee?
It can if a devotee is associating with Mayavadi.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's tempting. Because Iccha Dvesa Samuttena Dvandvamena Bharata, the living entity in this material world is covered by lust and hate, lust and envy. So the envy is quite at the root of our existence, that we want to take Krishna's place. So that's why Mayavad philosophy is attractive, because it feeds our envy. We can take Krishna's place. And one day, the curtains open and you'll stand on the altar.
Hmm. I hope not. Please. But there has been a case like that in the history of ISKCON. It has happened in Prabhupada's time. Somebody did that. And Jimi Hendrix took the body of Mahavishnu and put his own head on top on the cover of his record. Poor Jimmy. Okay, well, that was enough. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.